Become a sponsor today by visiting patreon.com/psychologyis.
Welcome to the Psychology Is podcast. I am your host, Nick Fortino. And today I have with me Dr. Don Newman. Welcome, Don.
Well, thank you, Nick. Great to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. For people who don't know, Dr. Newman is a tenured professor at the Indiana University School of Medicine in the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. You have a PhD in rehabilitation science and a master's degree in cognitive psychology. You've been an active researcher since 2009, and your papers primarily focus on the theme of the impacts of traumatic brain injuries, particularly on emotional processing, is my understanding.
That is correct.
Okay, fantastic. Well, it's wonderful to have you here as a guest on the 57th episode of the Psychology Is podcast. I have some questions prepared and many that will come to mind spontaneously. We have a special audience who, based on the data we look at, appears to have the capacity for listening to long-form conversations. So, what a gift. What
Kudos a gift. To you.
I know, right? And to the audience.
Yes, exactly.
Can you begin by just sharing with us about your work and your research?
Yeah, kind of a big question. So I'm going to try to kind of package this so that it's understandable and not rambling too much, so it all makes sense. And I think the best way to do that, and like you said, my area of research is a lot in emotion dysregulation, and processing of emotions, and with a special emphasis on social cognition and the way we process social information. And so I would say when I think about the research that I'm doing in the areas that I focus on most, there's three key areas that I've been working on since my dissertation, since graduating, or actually as part of my dissertation that has just kind of grown from there. And one of those areas I began working on as part of my doctoral project, and that was looking at how people with traumatic brain injury, so that's the population that I work with, that I'm mainly focused on, people typically who have had a brain injury years ago, so they're in the chronic phases of brain injury, and they're suffering from some, you know, difficulties with social cognition and emotion dysregulation. I started looking at their ability to recognize other people's emotions through facial expressions. And so that was one key area, because like I was saying, I'm interested in how they're processing social information. And one important piece of information that we get when we're interacting with other people and trying to understand what are other people thinking and feeling is through their facial expressions. And so at the time, it had come to my attention that people with brain injury will frequently lose the ability to do this, or at least develop some level of impairment and have some challenges with being able to do this. And it's particularly important because if they don't know, if they can't figure out how people are feeling, they can't process their facial expressions, it's likely to impact their ability to navigate interpersonal relationships, social conversations with other people, their relationships with friends and loved ones and family members. So it could have a pretty detrimental impact. And so that's one area of research where I started and still am doing some work in that area to this day, especially because in addition to not being able to understand how other people are feeling, if you don't know how other people are feeling, it's also going to impact your ability to empathize with others and develop these strong social connections that make life so important and so valuable. So that's kind of where I had gotten started, which interestingly led me into my second area of interest that I'm really passionate about, and that is that area is called alexithymia. So many of you who are listening to this podcast, tuning into Psychology Is, may be familiar with that term, but for those people who are not familiar with it, alexithymia literally translates into no words for emotions. And you don't have to have had a traumatic brain injury to have alexithymia, but a lot of people with TBI do seem to suffer from being able to process their own feelings and recognize what it is they're feeling, or recognize when they're having an emotional response, or how to label those feelings or differentiate those emotions from one another. And so I sort of backed into this area of interest because as I was doing my work on facial affect recognition, it came to my attention that one of the ways that we recognize other people's emotions is by being able to recognize our own emotions through having that emotional experience ourselves, and say, okay, well, I have been sad myself. I've been anxious or worried, and I know what that feels like, and I know what that looks like, and therefore I can recognize it in other people. Well, I started to dig into the research there and realized that a lot of people with traumatic brain injury have difficulty with this. And so as I was digging into this research, I realized that it's much more impactful and significant than just having, just interfering with one's inability to recognize how other people are feeling, but more importantly, maybe more importantly, depending on your take of it, is if you don't recognize when you're having an emotional response or what you're feeling, it can really put you in a position where how do you regulate an emotion or manage your emotion if you don't know you're having an emotional response or what that emotional response is?
Really?
And so that became a really, really important area for me because I started to think, well, geez, maybe this is sort of the foundation, kind of the beginning of all of these emotional problems that we're seeing after traumatic brain injury. And not that this is driving everything, but if somebody has, with a traumatic brain injury, has alexithymia, has poor emotional insight, I mean, that's a fundamental precursor to kind of building anything from there. And so I started tackling that in terms of really trying to understand factors that it's associated with, things that it predicts, and learning that it, you know, from our research that it does, you know, if you have alexithymia after brain injury, that it is impacting and predicting worse emotional functioning, lower resilience later on. As a longer term outcome. And so thinking that this is something that we need to see if it's modifiable, can this be something that's addressed with treatment? Can we develop an intervention to teach people with brain injury how to recognize their emotions? And, you know, I think it's important to point out that some of our patients with traumatic brain injury that come to us, if they have alexithymia, that may or may not have been caused from their traumatic brain injury. It could be something that they had developed earlier in life through the way they were socialized. So if you're raised in such a way that, you know, not to pay attention to your emotions, or emotions aren't important, or that's not what we need to focus on, and we just need to buck up and deal with the situation, you know, they can have alexithymia. Or individuals who have been confronted with psychological traumas, so not necessarily neurological damage that can cause a disruption in that process, but the psychological trauma can cause individuals to have characteristics of alexithymia. So there's lots of reasons, but regardless of the reason, if somebody has alexithymia and they come to us and they have emotion dysregulation, we want to be able to treat it. So we developed the treatment for alexithymia, and that's been a big part of my research over the last 10-ish years, I want to say, developing that intervention, pilot testing it. We just recently completed a larger randomized waitlist control trial on people with moderate to severe TBI, and We're currently running a trial that's funded by the Department of Defense in individuals with mild traumatic brain injury in civilians, as well as service members and veterans who have problems with alexithymia and emotion dysregulation.
Wow. And so I want to hear, of course, about what that intervention entails, but maybe right before we delve into that, I just want to kind of emphasize what you said, that I gather what you're saying is that it appears that alexithymia can be brought about by traumatic brain injuries, but that it's not restricted to the population of people who have had these injuries, and that it can be brought about by other factors as well. And so, potentially, any demographic of people could exhibit these characteristics. And you explained it clearly, but just in case anyone's still trying to get a good grasp on exactly what alexithymia is, can you define it for us?
So, other than kind of that, kind of what does it literally break down into? It's really this, it's almost like this emotional blind spot to some degree. So it's impaired emotional self-awareness. So, it really has a lot of different characteristics, and not every person has to have every characteristic. So some people may have one characteristic more than another. So it may present different in different people, but people with alexithymia can have difficulties even recognizing when they're having an emotional response. So, I guess an example I frequently use for this is, you might be talking to an individual and they might be getting really riled up and very agitated, and you could tell that they're clearly angry from, the escalation in their voice, their clenched fists and kind of popping veins. And you might say to this person, hey, there's really no need to get angry. And this person may have no idea they're angry. So they're having this clear emotional response, but yet at the same time to them, they are completely oblivious to having this emotional response. So just not even acknowledging that it's there, even though it's there. Then there's another set of individuals who maybe I would imagine it's probably more common in people with traumatic brain injury than maybe other populations, but we see a lot of people in our patient population who have blunted affect. So, there is very little affect going on. They're very kind of even keel and neutral in the way their presentation. And they will often say, like, I no longer have or feel or experience emotions anymore. And they, on the outside, don't even look like they do. But it is very possible that internally things are happening. And we had a really interesting case, actually, where we had a patient come in, and he had this wasn't a TBI, but it was a stroke. And he and his wife were complaining because of this lack of affect. And I was like, well, are we so sure that he no longer has any emotions, or is it a disconnect between what's going on internally and his ability to kind of acknowledge and process that information and for it to be expressed externally? And so we had gotten some equipment to measure his kind of systemic arousal through galvanic skin response. And we interviewed him with a series of very emotional personal pictures of his, and talked about his wedding day and the birth of his children. And, externally, his face is not showing any emotional expression whatsoever. But every time we brought up one of those emotional stimuli that was very personal to him, you could see the spike in his response. So it was very clear that something internally was going on. So there's this disconnect.
Interesting. And so was he able to report that, or was there also the disconnect between that physiological response and his own self-reporting?
Oh, total disconnect. Uh-huh. He had no idea.
Yeah. Wow. That's very interesting.
No idea, but and so frustrating for family members, because that emotional connection. Sometimes you'd rather somebody get angry and mad than have no emotion whatsoever. Yeah. I mean, it was so disruptive to their family. Like, she would do things to trick him to try to elicit an emotional response. Like, she made it seem that their child went missing at a fair just to elicit an emotional response. And he reacted, but in a logical way, interestingly enough. He's like, okay, well, let's look for her here or here, but not, he didn't get that emotional response she was looking for. Yeah. Yeah. So that's another way. Every time I do this and talk about it, I try to talk about kind of the clinical signs and symptoms, because I really think it's very helpful to kind of put like a picture to what it could look like. I think other ways that it could come across and manifest itself is, and we'll frequently see this, people, not a lot of people do this in life, but like you talk in vagaries about emotions. But when you're talking with when you're talking to like a cashier somewhere, and somebody says, how are you? You're not going to delve into your details of your emotions. But if you're talking to a family member or you're talking to a therapist because you're having emotional problems, you need to talk in more specifics. Like, you should be talking in more detail and not just talking about factual information, but how you feel in specific. So, but these people will talk about like, okay, I'm okay, I'm fine. They will have difficulty using specific emotions. So it will have a hard time with granularity and what it is that they're feeling, or a breadth of emotions. And then, they're going to be more likely when you ask them how they feel to talk about their thoughts or their actions or physical sensations. So I feel that this is stupid, or I feel that I'm being treated unfairly, or I feel this person is a jerk, or I feel like throwing up, or I feel tired, or I feel pain. But they're less likely to talk about the emotional experience in some discreet way. So they're just really having a difficult time really understanding what it is that they're feeling.
As you're talking about this, and as I've contemplated this before, I kind of picture a big continuum, perhaps it being a bell curve, where on one extreme end of the spectrum, we have those people who are exquisitely self-aware. They have the highest level of emotional awareness. They understand and monitor the fluctuations of their feelings and the origins of those feelings, and they process them and channel them and express them in the healthiest manner. And then on the other end of the spectrum, what perhaps may be alexithymia. But my question is, and then of course, the middle of the bell curve being where the majority of people are, which is some sort of average level of self-awareness and emotional intelligence, essentially. So do you think of alexithymia as being continuous with normal, or as a separate category?
Yeah, absolutely. It's on a continuum from low to high. One of the most common measures out there that's used to evaluate alexithymia is the Toronto Alexithymia Scale 20. A more recent one is from Perth. This is the Perth Alexithymia Questionnaire. They are on a continuum. They're on a continuous scale from low to high. So you don't talk. A lot of times I talk about somebody with or without alexithymia, but I don't really mean it like it's discrete. It's there or not. It's there in levels. And you kind of have your typical, your standardized norm, and then you have people that fall above that norm. So higher alexithymia being worse, you have people that fall above that kind of standard deviation of the average.
Which I think is actually encouraging, perhaps, because I think sometimes when people think of various conditions, whether it's this or some psychological disorder, when they begin to think of it as a discrete condition, I think it makes it seem like improvement is not possible. Mm-hmm. It seems like they're almost trapped in this category.
Yeah.
And that within this category, maybe they can see some improvement, but they're always going to be in this category. Whereas I don't think that's true of most disorders, and perhaps as well with alexithymia, that one could and this is probably a good segue into talking about the intervention you've developed, but one could, through the right support, improve so much that they would no longer be considered as having that condition. So I think it's encouraging. Absolutely. Think of it in this way.
No, I think you're absolutely right in thinking of it that way. And I mean, we do know that alexithymia is something that can change. It can fluctuate in people, you know, it can be reduced over time. And it frustrates me too, because when this term came about in the 70s, I forgot who developed it, Syphneos, I think, in the 70s, I believe. And it was came about what with regards to, see, I'm not a clinical psychologist, so you have to kind of forgive me and give me a little latitude there, but it went with somatization is when this all sort of came about. Kind of people taking those somatic feelings and that feeling of discomfort, and people talking about this as a trait. When we talk about traits, people think it's definitive, it's not changeable, right? And so it's like, I don't really want to talk about it as a trait. There are characteristics, but these things can be modified.
Yes. Well, on that note, how can one modify characteristics? What does the intervention entail?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, when we set about to create this intervention, we very much took the thinking about making sure that we were targeting all of the characteristics that we know are common, you know, that commonly seen and observed in people with alexithymia, and said, okay, well, let's make sure that we address each of these areas. So when you look at the Toronto Alexithymia Scale, now that I think about it, it might have been an easier way to sort of describe what is alexithymia. However, I like to sort of make it come to life with kind of those clinical presentations. But the Toronto Alexithymia Scale has three subscales. And one of those is difficulty identifying feelings, which really is that it's more of that recognition of that emotional response, that onset. Then there is the difficulty describing feelings as a second subscale. So being able to label your emotional expressions, and being able to differentiate. So this questional, you know, part of that measure is, you know, do you have difficulty distinguishing from anger and sadness and fear? And then that the last subscale is externally oriented thinking, and that you're kind of this type of person. If you're externally oriented thinking, you're less likely to think about those internal emotional feelings, but more kind of external, more factual based. You're going to be more interested in talking about how your day was than how you felt about your day and how that went. And so keeping that in mind, and those were the guiding principles in developing the intervention. But, you know, the first part of the intervention is really about having people establishing buy-in, because a lot of people don't think that there's value in getting in touch with their emotions, and that they just kind of, they don't want to think about them. And so we spent a lot of time talking about what are the negative consequences of not being in touch with your emotions. And that, you know, if you're not aware of them, they're more likely to have control over you than you having a position, being in a position to decide how and what you want to do with them, and being able to manage those emotions, how they're important for building and establishing relationships and maintaining relationships and empathy. It's important for physical health and psychological health. You know, a lot of people, with alexithymia, there's a whole researcher, that sounds ridiculous. There's a whole body of literature and research that have shown relationships between alexithymia and chronic pain. And one of the big researchers in that area that I collaborate with now is Mark Lemley from Wayne State University. And it's really no surprise that, you know, if you're having these kind of sensations in your body that you can't quite understand, you know, it's contributing to pain. So, you know, we're talking about, hey, you need to get in touch with these things for various reasons. And then if you are kind of suffering, like just being able to vent and talk to friends and family members or a therapist, but it's going to put you in a position where you can do that better. So after we sort of establish, hey, this is why you want to get better at this, now we have buy-in, and we spend a lot of time talking about emotional vocabulary. And it's not like any nuanced emotions at all. We use really basic emotional labels. I mean, we are working with people with traumatic brain injury, but it's really getting people so used to getting those emotional labels and vocabulary in the forefront of their brain, so that right. they can get used to incorporating it into the way they talk and the and kind of that self-reflection and right. being able to utilize it, whether it is through talking to other people or through self-talk, because we acknowledge that for some of these people, it's going to be, you know, these people may have never done this their whole life to talk to other people about emotions, and that's just not who I am. So we say that's, you know, that's okay, but you still need to be honest and truthful with yourself. So figuring it out internally, this internal dialogue. And we have something called an emotional compass. And essentially, it probably most psychologists have seen kind of that, the valence arousal chart, where you have the valence on the x-axis and the arousal on the y-axis. We teach people kind of how to, you know, distinguish if they're feeling pleasant or unpleasant, and if they're and what arousal is, because that arousal is really important for giving you those are the cues, the body indicators as to, hey, I'm having an emotional response, right? So we do a little bit of body mindfulness and body scanning just to kind of see what's going on and being in tune to that, and what are the symptoms of change, shifting from a baseline arousal, and noticing when those things change and what do those indicators, those cues mean. And so that when somebody's having, there's an event, something happens, you could say, okay, well, where was it on the valence scale? And where is it on the arousal scale? How much did it shift from your baseline? And so we're really trying to lower that threshold of detecting a deviation from baseline, and then helping them put an emotional label. So with our compass, we could help them navigate and say, okay, are you in this quadrant? Here are a lot of typical emotions that are in this quadrant. Do any of these resonate with how you might be feeling at this particular time?
Yes.
And so, yeah, so those are a couple things. We do a lot of, we spend a lot of time teaching the difference between thoughts, how emotions differ from thoughts, actions, and physical sensations, and how they shouldn't try to interchange when somebody asks how they're feeling. To not saying that, we're all so used to saying I feel and insert it with anything that's not an emotion, that's either a thought, a physical, we all do that, but to know when you actually didn't say an emotional word and kind of try to think about it and kind of say, okay, well, I didn't respond with an actual emotion. And so to try to know that difference. And then we talk about using that information so that you can, not to confuse your emotions with those things, but to use it to tap into your emotions. So TAP being an acronym for thoughts, actions, and physical sensations, using those things to tap into what you might be feeling, to sort of triangulate that, to understand what you're feeling, but not to confuse it.
Can you give an example of the difference between saying I feel an actual emotion versus a term that would indicate more of a thought?
Yeah, I mean, so something like, you know, something like if I said, I feel like it was really unfair that I got passed over for that promotion, and I feel that my boss was just being a jerk, and I feel that, you know, I just want to kind of crawl in a hole. You know, some of these thoughts might actually be indicating anger, embarrassment, shame, So to kind of take some of those thoughts and to be like, okay, you know, this is, you know, I feel, you know, that I'm never going to get a job again. And how I, you know, I'm feeling like I'm never going to, we're going to lose this house. Like, these are things that you could say, well, that's worry, that's fear, right. That's anxiety, shame, disappointment, like all of these other things. It's helpful, like, but not necessarily. So I might say those things, and to me, those things are those emotions, but for somebody else, they could have a whole different set of emotions if they said those same things. So it's not, so that's what we try to convey to people, that just because I said this out loud and most people might equate this thought with this emotion, or you might equate this thought with this emotion, other people might not.
Right.
And so in order to give people more clarity in what you're feeling, you can't just be talking about what you're thinking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In order to give people more clarity. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like that's one of the, it's speaking of buy-in and like the value of being able to express what you're feeling and know what you're feeling, is in order to elicit the response that would be supportive,
right,
from other people. And if a person doesn't quite know what you're feeling, it's difficult to respond with the right emotional response.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think the other issue is when you don't really know how you're feeling, the knee-jerk reaction, especially for a lot of folks with their TBI, but I bet many others as well, is anger.
Yeah.
Right? And so anger is this first level response. And what I will say, and you know, that's another, I guess, clinical characteristic or kind of way that alexithymia will come about, is like, people can be very, very emotional, know that they're having an emotional response, but they'll often talk about it as feeling flooded or overwhelmed or stressed, but they can't really get through anything else. And all of that translates to this outward level of anger. So just because somebody can identify they have anger does not mean they don't have alexithymia. A lot of people with alexithymia realize that they have anger, but the problem is that anger is often this secondary emotion, or it's accompanied by many other things. It might not be, you know, not to say your anger is not wrong or it's not valid, or maybe it is a primary emotion, but I guarantee you there are other emotions that are accompanying it. And when all you have to express is kind of, you go sort of on this attack, people are going to get on the defensive. So you're not, like, if you're feeling anxious or sad, but you're coming across as angry, you know, because your loved one came home 2 hours late and you start yelling and screaming at them, or, you know, you weren't invited to go out with your friends for a beer, all this yelling and screaming, like, that attack isn't going to get you very far. If you say, well, I was really, you know, saddened that I wasn't invited to come along with you guys, or, man, I was so worried that you got, you know, I thought you were supposed to be home 2 hours ago, and I love and I care about you, and I was super worried, you know, and the next time, can you just call? That's going to be better than, you know, screaming like, you're so inconsiderate and, you know, what's wrong with you? Like, so identifying that you felt fear because you care about somebody, or you felt disappointed or sad because you weren't invited to go out with your friend, like, this is going to be received a lot better than going on the attack. So we spent a lot of time too talking about disentangling multiple emotions, that you always feel more than one emotion in response to a situation. And how do you kind of pick apart? Because when you feel more than one emotion, especially when they might be kind of disparate emotions, or, you know, kind of on different ends of the spectrum, it could lead to one feeling confused. So it's not uncommon for people to say, I feel confused. Or, you know, you ask them how they feel, they're like, I feel confused, or I feel indifferent. You know, it's really helping them figure out, like, getting through all the noise, really. And so, you know, so we'll do that. And again, talking more about anger and one of these other emotions. And all of that happens over 4 sessions, and then we spend the lot. And so there's a lot of exercises, personalized exercises that we go through to make sure they're understanding the concepts. And then the last 4 exercises, we have these first person based videos of these like emotional scenarios that happen to a lot of different people for whatever reasons. And so then they're asked to put into play, to implement the skills that they learn. So after each scenario, they're asked to talk about what would they be thinking, what would they be feeling, their physical sensations be, their desired actions, and then what their actual emotion would be. And they're then prompted for multiple emotional responses and stuff. So it gives them an opportunity to practice processing their emotions when something of a higher level of arousal is happening to them.
Right. And sorry if you said it and I didn't catch it, but is there a name for this intervention?
That has a couple different names. So we just finished a randomized controlled trial where we're analyzing the data from that. And we call that training to reconnect with emotional awareness therapy. So TREAT, we call it the TREAT trial. And now more recently, the Department of Defense study that we're doing with the military, in people with mild traumatic brain injury, we are calling that building emotional self-awareness teletherapy, because that is being delivered through teletherapy. So we're calling that the best trial, but it's essentially, it's the same intervention. The latter is more recent. So we kind of hone it up, you know, add some finishing touches to it. So, but ultimately it's the same intervention. It's being delivered through Zoom primarily.
Right. That's fantastic. A question about traumatic brain injuries a little bit more generally. Two main questions. And the first one is, when we talk about traumatic brain injuries and exactly what they are, I think most people think of that as being the result of a physical injury. But would you classify a psychological trauma that results in neurological changes to be a traumatic brain injury?
So it's a great question. And a lot of people make that mistake in thinking that might be a traumatic brain injury. To classify as a traumatic brain injury, it has to be due to an external physical force hitting the head hitting an external physical force that's going to lead to mechanical disruption in brain processing.
Okay.
So even things like a stroke is not a traumatic brain injury, because that's not an external physical force. A brain tumor, a seizure, these things are not considered to be traumatic brain injury. Those are acquired brain injuries, but they're not traumatic brain injuries. So, so like your most common traumatic brain injury nowadays are falls. And that's primarily driven by the younger and the older population. So children falling and adults falling is what's driving that being the largest percentage accounting for traumatic brain injuries, followed by motor vehicle accidents.
Okay. Okay. Well, then the second question is, in your estimation, how often do TBIs go undiagnosed? And if I may add a follow-up question before you answer that, is it conceivable that some or even many of the problematic psychological conditions that people experience could be a result of an undiagnosed, perhaps low-grade traumatic brain injury?
Yes. So I think in all of the estimates that are out there for traumatic brain injury, I mean, these are super conservative estimates, because TBI goes undiagnosed all the time. It's very common where people won't go to the emergency department for a traumatic brain injury. I mean, especially with, you know, sports or what have you, like people, especially you have a concussion, not everybody, especially back in the day, not everybody would go to the hospital. And so it's, I don't know how common, but we do know that it's relatively common. And we see this frequently, especially in the prison population. It is, and that's an area where it's extremely undiagnosed, or the homeless population, people that don't have access to health care, So you know, there are a group of researchers that are interested, and I do some research in the prison population, but there's researchers that do that in prison as well as homeless, et cetera. And there's, we do these interviews to determine, you know, to see if people have TBI, and these people are shocked. They had no idea. They had no idea. And then some people who have gone to the hospital, we don't have any idea that they've had a brain injury, because they might have gone there if they gotten in a car accident and there's other injuries, you know, more physical injuries or other things that are, you know, maybe more dire at the time or more obvious, more physically obvious, visibly obvious. That's what they're being treated for. It's their primary injury. So they may very well walk away without knowing or have been classified as having a TBI, and then they go home and they have all of these problems. So absolutely.
So what is the most reliable way to diagnose a traumatic brain injury?
I think, I was thinking about this too, because you sent that list, and it's interesting, because at first I'd say, you know, medical records. So it's like, I think if somebody has a moderate or severe brain injury, so there's different grades. I mean, we talk about brain injury in terms of different grades of mild, moderate, and severe, which I do think might eventually go away, because when we talk about that, it confuses people, because somebody who had a mild traumatic brain injury could have very severe consequences or problems, lingering problems. But when you think about, well, you just had a mild TBI, why do you have all these issues? Or then you have, or you have somebody who had a severe TBI and maybe they were in a coma for a month, but their recovery is outstanding. And so it doesn't really capture things. And so it's a little bit confusing. But that said, there are, we talk about that initial event, the injury itself, and we talk about this, that grading. Moderate and severe, that's more likely going to land you, that's going to land you in a hospital. It's going to land you hospitalized, and you're going to have some medical records. You're going to have some indication if you do a CT scan or an MRI lightly. You most likely have, you know, you've lost some, you know, consciousness, and they do what's called the Glasgow Coma Scale on you, and they're going to learn your level of responsiveness at the scene. And so you have that. But, you know, when you have a more mild, a concussion, mild traumatic brain injury, those very easily go undetected. And so, you know, and you might not wind up in the hospital, or even if you do wind up in the hospital, medical records are not necessarily going to cut it, because even imaging, CT scans, it's not going to show up on that. So that's not going to necessarily be reliable. Or it may or may not. So that's not necessarily going to be reliable. One of the things I like to use in lieu of medical records, especially when there's more mild traumatic brain injury, is there's a standardized measure created that's called the Ohio State University TBI Identification Method. And it is a standardized evidence-based method for determining whether or not somebody's had a traumatic brain injury. It's an interview. It's fairly easy to administer, but essentially there's three parts to it. But essentially you're asking people, have you ever been hospitalized for a brain injury, or not for brain injury, have you ever been hospitalized due to in the emergency following an injury to your head or your neck? Because people don't necessarily think about their brain, but they might have hit their head, or they might have hurt their neck that led to that, which is also likely to coincide with the brain kind of shifting inside the skull and causing, you know, a brain injury. Have you ever fallen and hit your head? Things of that nature. And then we document cause. And then after that, they get asked questions about loss of consciousness, duration of consciousness, and whether or not they were dazed and confused at the incident.
Right.
So typically, if somebody hit their head and there was no loss of consciousness at all, or no level of dazed and confused, we really don't deem that as having had a traumatic brain injury. You hit your head, it didn't really cause any disruption. If you had loss of consciousness for less than 30 minutes, or you were just dazed and confused at the time, that's like a mild grade TBI. And then if you've had loss of consciousness for more than 30 minutes or less than 24 hours. It's more moderate to brain injury. And then more loss of consciousness for longer than 24 hours. It's a more severe TBI. But it's really nice to be able to utilize this standardized method for documenting, in especially when there's no medical information charts to be found.
To what degree can we rehabilitate the brain itself? I say that with in mind all approaches from psychological interventions and behavioral interventions to neurosurgery and anything we can think of to sort of repair and rehabilitate the brain, you know, and I know this is like a massive question that people from various fields could speak to, but just what's your take on the degree to which a person's brain, whether they've been mildly, moderately, or severely traumatized, can be restored to a normal functioning?
So we see, it's a big question. We see a huge spectrum of recovery, of rehabilitation, and it is influenced by a whole bunch of factors, some factors we know, some factors we don't. I don't think I had mentioned to you before, but it's definitely worth noting. I think your audience would be interested in knowing it. We are a part of where I'm at the Indiana University. We are a traumatic brain injury model systems hospital. And what that means is that, so there's 16 traumatic brain injury sites in the United States. And it is basically a grant funded through NIDLR, the National Institute on Disability Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. I bring this up for a reason. So essentially what it is with all of these sites, we wind up enrolling patients during a subacute phase while they're in inpatient rehabilitation. And we follow them throughout the course of their lifetime to look at recovery. So it's kind of like the Framingham study, but for traumatic brain injury, and sort of understanding the course of recovery, the trajectory of recovery. And one of the things that, we've learned from that is that it seems like, there's a third of people that seem to have a really great recovery, a third who might not recover so well, and a third who might kind of stay static. There's a lot of factors that could influence it, and the way that those factors, potentially interacting. And so whether, there is some sort of selection bias in our sample of the fact that these people had access to inpatient rehabilitation, and there's an insurance at most of these sites, et cetera, and they've gotten some follow-up rehabilitation, So, the brain can heal on its own to an extent. And that's a lot of that recovery on its own. There's going to be a drastic amount of recovery in the first few months after a brain injury. That's a prime time for rehabilitation, and also its own recovery. But at the same time, that recovery can happen many, many, many years after brain injury, but it's unlikely to happen on its own without intervention, without clinicians and rehabilitation. There's factors, those factors, access to care, there's social support systems, there are pre-injury factors, number of prior brain injuries, pre-mental health, substance use, these are all factors that we know come into play, what we're investigating coming into play, that we think come into play, genetics that may come into play. Injury severity, there's a lot of different components that will factor into that and the recovery. But I think that it is, that is a big area too, right now, especially when you have people with more severe injuries who have been comatose, that have disorders of consciousness, and not, you know, not alert for months and months after their injury, or you're or doctors in the very beginning, and they're trying to make these decisions about, do you keep these person on these patients on life sustaining, through medical, interventions and stuff, or do you not? And what's this person's prognosis for a good quality of life? And what is a good quality of life and how subjective that is?
Right. I appreciate that well-rounded answer. But it seems like the future is bright. It seems like we're getting closer and closer to figuring out, the right multi-dimensional treatment protocols for all the various ways in which our brains can be injured. And then there's also, of course, preventing it from ever happening in the first place, which leads me to my next question. What are your thoughts about tackle football?
I have a lot of thoughts. trying to wrangle them all in. And it's interesting because you say tackle football, but what about hockey? What about soccer?
Yeah,
those are right. Other sports that are, common sports where we see patients coming in who suffer injuries or multiple injuries. And, hey, if I had a kid playing one of those sports, would I be nervous? Yes. I think very nervous. Would I stop them from playing one of those sports? I don't know. I don't think so. I think, there's a lot of pros and benefits from playing sports. I think, there's still a lot to be learned about sports and the impact. It's certainly having an effect. I think we're never getting rid of sports in the United, we're not going to get rid of sports. We're not going to get rid of tackle football. I think that there's going to be potentially changes, in the future in terms of, when do you introduce tackle football at what age, or checking in hockey? I know that that's been a long time to discussion of has your brain fully been developed? Are you, do you have the skills to, do you know how to handle, being checked playing hockey, or how to tackle somebody, or how, so there's certain skills and, potentially age that will come into play. There's, I think better helmets are continually being improved upon. I think they're continuing to improve the protocol for return to play, and making sure that we're not just brushing off concussions, and getting people back out there before they're ready. I mean, that's one of the worst things you could do is have a concussion, get somebody back on the field, and then have them have a concussion before they've even healed. We see that very frequently, that sometimes multiple concussions are worse than one severe traumatic brain injury. And so it really is that. And at what point do you then call it quits? Before my brain takes any more of a beating at this point, and there's more long-term consequences to this. So, I think that, I think we need to kind of be more mindful and thoughtful about some of these other factors, and be realistic about the sport.
Yeah, I appreciate that answer. And honestly, I played football, and football has been one of the most important things in my life, actually. Ever since I was a little kid, I've been obsessed with it. And I played tackle football for, throughout high school and a couple of years at a community college. And it was truly one of the most important formative experiences of my life and of my masculinity. And I have a son. He's now 10 years old. and he's starting to love football and he really wants to play. So I, along with, you know, so many thousands of parents out there, am torn, because it's interesting, and I hope you don't mind my, you know, reflecting on this.
No,
here,
go.
But,
go ahead.
If, you know, obviously everyone does a risk reward analysis calculation. And if the reward wasn't that great and the risk is what it is, then no one would play football. But the reward is truly great. It's the experience, you know, honestly, especially for a boy becoming a man, it's like the closest thing to being a warrior that you can do without actually going to war and being a warrior. You really get in touch with a very primal part of yourself, and one that I believe is very important to get in touch with as a boy becoming a man. And just the level of intensity, the competition, the camaraderie, the feeling that you're going to battle to play a violent game against other people, it's all very, very just meaningful, exhilarating, and rewarding. And so that's the reward factor that I have to calculate in
right.
to my reward calculation.
Right.
And so the scary thing though is that my impression is growing that the risk level is high. And I see your reaction here. That's interesting. Like you know, you're not quick to get on board with that statement that the risk level is high.
Well, so it's interesting because I don't know how many people have had a more moderate or severe traumatic brain injury from sports. What's the prevalence of that? When I said to you what the prevalence is, and this is from the CDC, the highest prevalence of injury is a fall. It's not sports.
Right.
Right. And so you're more likely to have a brain injury from a fall, you know, or a car accident. I think, like you said, there are tons of benefits to playing sports. My thought is, if you're going about it, and yeah, just in my own opinion, just being approaching it from a smart way of making sure children know how to be tackled or how to be whatever, and that they're of age, like that makes sense, that the coaches are cognizant and, you know, being responsible, that you're being responsible, they're getting checked out. If, you know, now if you have one, now you have a time that, well, your child had a concussion and how severe was that? It's like, that's when you want to start saying, well, do you want to continue to go down that path? You know, or is it time to stop? You know, when is that risk reward no longer being more rewarding than the risk? You know, we had somebody in our research study, she played soccer. She had more than 5 concussions from soccer and dealing with a tremendous amount of pain and all kinds of consequences. So like, you know, you start to think, well, at that point, do you stop? And now she's an athlete. She's borderline professional athlete. Like, you have to decide at that point, right. Do I decide that this is not going to be my career or what have you? Because like I said, if you stop your child from playing sports, but then they turn around and get in a car accident,
right? Yeah, no, I mean, I appreciate that answer, and my son will appreciate your answer even more.
I'm sure people are hating me. They're going to hear this podcast. I'm going to get a bunch of hate mail. I think you have to do what's right for you. You know, what's right for you and your family. I can't dictate, you know, oh, the risk level is too high. You know?
I think you're being totally reasonable. I think there's unreasonable positions that say yes and no to playing sports. You know, I think there are people who are just close-minded. Again, on either end, closed-minded to hearing the risks or closed-minded to hearing the rewards and the possibility that they outweigh the risks. So I really do. I appreciate your response. I think you're being reasonable.
Wow. So I'm put this one in the calendar.
Yeah. Well, I know I'll continue to contemplate it and kind of, you know, attempt to cultivate clarity around it. And I think you're right too, that the game, all the games are changing, and the awareness of the risk is growing, and the equipment is getting better. And even if, you know, I'm an avid NFL fan, and just, you know, the way that the rules are changing, the way that players are allowed to hit each other now is dramatically different than it used to be. And there's always going to be an inherent risk in colliding with another man running at you. But I do think there are ways to reduce that risk. And like you said, to know how to play in a way that reduces the risk, know how to take contact, know how to tackle. So anyway, I appreciate you sharing your perspective on it. And it seems like you do understand. I mean, did you play sports yourself?
Not a contact sport. I played gymnastics. So,
okay.
Which I could have hit my head. Fortunately, I didn't. I just dislocated my kneecap, but which also, you know, wasn't fun. But, you know, I think also just to add to, I think, again, emphasizing when, if you do have a child or somebody, a loved one that's playing sports, if they do have a concussion, that it should be taken seriously, that you really do have to think about the return to play before they go back. You don't want them to be going back too soon. You know, and I think there's always that risk because kids know that they're going to be taken. So it's like making sure that they are being truthful in describing kind of the symptoms that they might be experiencing and understand the consequences if they're not being truthful. And, you know, it's not worth it. And there are ways, there's been some newer protocols. Very interesting group out of the University of Buffalo, actually my former mentor and his colleague. So my former mentor, Dr. Barry Wheeler, and his colleague, John Letty, have been sort of leading the forge in terms of like return to play and kind of shifting the whole way of after concussions, it's all about rest, rest, rest. And instead of rest, 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 they do kind of this, gradual increasing of threshold when you have a concussion, you're symptomatic of work exercising until you start triggering symptoms. And so it's this gradual. So you're not going at rest for 4 weeks or whatever, which starts to cause depression and all deconditioning and all these other problems in athletes. They're actually working with them so that they're continuing to exercise and building up their you know, that threshold, or, you know, that threshold for reducing for symptom onset.
Right. That's very interesting.
Yeah. They're very cool. Dr. John Letty they've really started changing a lot about return to play.
Wow. Well, let me ask just this final question. As someone like yourself who has become an expert in brain science. I don't know if you would say that for yourself, but you certainly strike me as an expert in brain science and who understands the preciousness of the brain, the fragility of the brain, the consequences of it being injured. What are some things that you do personally to protect and nourish your brain?
By the way, before I answer that question, I just have to say it was kind of funny because what you just said reminded me. We have friends that call me the female brain investigator. They want to get me like an FBI shirt, like the female, the FBI, just a different kind of FBI.
Like it.
Yes, I love it too. It's kind of fun. I wear my seatbelt. I'm a safe, I consider myself an ultra safe driver, that I'm not an ultra aggressive driver. Those are probably the two biggest things. I don't take unnecessary risks at doing things. You know, my partner, he'll say to you, you know, we got this house. He's like, he was going to clean the gutters and do all of these things. And I'm like, you are not getting up and cleaning those gutters. Pay somebody. Pay somebody to do the stuff. Pay somebody to clean the gutters. Pay somebody, you know, like even when he gets on a ladder to get something out of our garage, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I cringe. Yeah. Oh, I don't. Just don't do it. And then we'll get the people to come clean the gutters. I'm like, you should really be wearing helmets. They all look at me like I'm nuts.
Hey, I'm sure no one has ever told them that before while they're on the job.
You know, now they're like, what? I'm like, I'm not worried about suing you, you know, getting sued. I'm worried about your health. I don't want you to become a patient of mine. You know, you get on a bike, you do whatever, you wear your helmets. Be serious about that. Yeah, I mean, those are probably the big things.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's noteworthy that it's amazing how many biological mechanisms are built in to protect the brain. You know, our skulls and the blood-brain barrier and cerebrospinal fluid and, you know, so it's like, I hope that people aren't listening and coming away feeling irrationally afraid of life and of getting an injury, because of course we have evolved in such a way that our brains are relatively protected inside of our skulls. And yet, you know, especially for anyone who's ever held a brain in their hands, it's a soft organ, and those processes and bones inside of our skull are sharp and pointy. And so it really is interesting to, like, you know, I work at Gavilan College, which is in California, and I collaborate with the biology instructors on campus. And so I have a biological psychology class, and we go view the cadavers every semester, and it always works out that we're able to use the bone saw and cut open the skull and remove the brain from the body. And so it's an unforgettable learning experience for myself and my students, and I've been doing it now for years, and it never fails to amaze me, you know, just how fragile the brain appears to me.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of balancing things
yes,
out.
Yes, you
here.
Are. Like you went from being it's resilient and it's super fragile, but you're right. It is. It's both. And I totally agree with you. So when I was at the University of Buffalo, I was a teaching assistant and I was a TA for the neuroanatomy class and the neuroanatomy lab, which we would also, well, I'm sure the other part of the class did the removing of the brain from the skulls. I had to miss the one day that people were doing it. I was kind of bummed out. I heard it smells like Doritos. But anyway, aside from that, we would have a thing there. It was called the think tank. And so like my job, like, so we had this big tub of brains, and it was my job before the class to take out the brains and give every table a brain and a half. Like, okay, I have to take out the brain. We gotta cut it now. Oh man, I love doing that. That was precious. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Fascinating, mm-hmm. Right?
It definitely, for sure. It's a privilege. It certainly was. But I would also say, but you're right. There is a lot of protective factors, and like I said, there's these premorbid things too that help protect. That are protective too, after, you know, for people who have encountered a brain injury. And I will say, plugging my own research for alexithymia, I mean, some of the research that has been done, not me, an investigator out of the UK, he had conducted this one study that showed that people who had alexithymia were more likely to develop post-concussion syndrome. So the moral of the story is that you should work on your, if you want to be preemptive, be proactive, you know, if you want to be more resilient to physical trauma, physiological trauma, psychological trauma, then really strengthen up your ability to know your emotions. Because that, being able to do that is really important for overcoming some of the trauma and problems.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I've loved every minute of this conversation, Doc.
Well, good. I'm glad I didn't bore you, flit in for your listeners. It was definitely enjoyable. As you could tell, I can go on and on about this topic.
Yeah. Your passion and your knowledge are evident. And thank you very much for sharing them with us.
No, it was my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.